Today's program has been brought to you by Fairway Market, like no other market, a New York City institution that sells the best local, national, and international artisan foods for prices that can't be beat. For more information, visit fairwaymarket.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Everybody, this is Phil Colicchio, and you are listening to The Business of the Business, the show that explores the business side of the restaurant and hospitality industries. And we air live every Wednesday at 5 p.m. on the Heritage Radio Network. That's heritageradionetwork.org. If you missed this broadcast, and I don't think anyone's ever missed it, but if you do, you can find us archived at heritageradionetwork.org at Business of the Business. And as a podcast on iTunes. 40 years is a long time. And in 40 years, we see businesses grow. We see them fall. We see them take two steps back. We see them take three steps forward. A lot of times businesses don't make it to 40. The lifespan of a hospitality business, of a restaurant, doesn't often get you to 40. But 40 years ago, James Beard did something that really made a dent in the restaurant industry. And it wasn't advancing the career of Julia Child. It wasn't advancing the career of a particular chef. 40 years ago, James Beard got sick and tired of preparing frozen poultry from Europe, frozen game birds. And he went on a quest to find locally raised, properly raised birds, such as quail, pheasant, etc. And he came upon a man by the name of George Rude. George is a Vietnam veteran. He lived in Princeton, New Jersey, still does. And George had a small farm that he ran for a couple of locals, upon which he raised quail and duck and partridge and pheasant. And that farm was known as the Griggstown Quail Farm, located in Princeton, New Jersey. Well, that was 40 years ago. The Griggstown Quail Farm is now a thriving business that does a heck of a lot more than quail. They've been supplying restaurants and specialty stores and consumers with terrific birds, produce, and much, much more. Today we have Mr. Rude's partner, the executive chef and head of the retail side of that business, Matt Seitzma. Good afternoon, Matt.
Hey, how you doing, everybody?
I hope they're doing well. Matt, we took a short ride out here to Brooklyn from Princeton, where we both live and work. Our area had a little trouble with the pretty terrible storm that came through. How did Griggstown Quail Farm make out in that storm?
We fared a lot better than a lot of people. We actually only lost power for about 12 hours, mm-hmm. Which was pretty remarkable. People who lived right next to the farm lost it for about 10 days. And the only real damage that we had on the farm was I lost one of our greenhouses, which at the end of the day isn't the end of the world.
Right. Now, I ask that because I'm particularly interested in the history of the farm.
Okay.
And because I know how many birds you raise, and that storm came during your peak bird season, which, you know, Thanksgiving area, when you raise a lot of turkeys. How many birds are on the farm at that period of time when that storm came in? How many were on the farm?
Probably 75,000 birds were on the farm at that time.
Did you lose any?
Not really. Most of the birds that, like the pheasants and the heritage breed turkeys, they're able to stay outside, and they're with a. I mean, they're a wild bird, so they can handle about anything. The chickens and our traditional white turkeys, they hunker down inside the barns.
Well, that's terrific. So preparation certainly helped, and again, that's emblematic of the way Griggstown handles not only its business but handles its truly its precious cargo, live birds.
Yep.
Matt, tell us a little bit about the history of the farm. I mentioned earlier that James Beard found George Rude, and a rustic love affair ensued. You and I know that's an inside joke because George Rude is a pretty rough and tumble guy, but he's been doing this for a long, long time. When did you begin your association with George Rude and the Griggstown Quail Farm?
The first time I met George, I was actually about 13 years old. I grew up on a small dairy farm in Sussex, New Jersey, and when I was about 13, my dad decided to sell the farm, and we moved down to the Princeton area. I grew up on the farm my whole life, and I wanted to stay in the agriculture business, even though at the time I knew that I wanted to get involved with cooking. So I rode my bike down to the farm and wanted to get a job working on the farm, and I was told that they don't hire kids. So that was the first time that I actually ever came into contact with George. So that was in the 97 or whatever. But over the years after that, I'd bump into George at the feed store and at the hardware store. Then once I went through culinary school, I started buying my poultry off of George.
Now, are you listening to this, people? We're talking about feed stores. We're talking about bumping into people at the hardware store. We're talking about New Jersey.
Yeah.
People forget that New Jersey has a very rural side to it, not very far away. As a matter of fact, the Griggstown Quail Farm is less than an hour from Manhattan.
Yeah, we can make it, you know, it seems like it's far, but, you know, the farm is very luckily strategically placed, about an hour from Philadelphia and an hour from New York. So even though it's a trek, it's a great place to come and check out.
Right. Now, Matt, you've got real culinary chops. You graduated from the Culinary Institute of America. You worked with Andrew Carmelini at Cafe Boulud. You worked with Craig Shelton at the Ryland Inn in New Jersey, which was for years acclaimed as the finest cuisine in New Jersey. Why did you leave the restaurant industry to move into something that was sort of a wholesale, potentially retail world, that is the quail farm?
I got into it. Farming is in my blood. I mean, like I said, I grew up on a farm. My dad was a farmer. My grandparents are farmers. So farming is part of who I am. And I was working a lot of hours in the restaurant, and I got kind of burnt out. And I wanted a girlfriend. I wanted a social life. I saw my friends having fun, and I felt like I was a slave to it. And I was having the time of my life. I was learning a lot, having fun, but I wanted something a little bit more relaxed, low pace, and something that I could do myself. And I knew that I didn't really want to own my own restaurant one day.
Now, I know you. Relaxed and slow paced does not correspond with the Matt Seitzma that I know, and I'll tell you why. Once you came on with George at the Griggstown Quail Farm, it ceased being a farm that raised birds. You saw real retail opportunities there. You told me a really funny story once about how you convinced George to take on a retail opportunity because he had started a little market. You told me a story about some chickens.
Yeah, so after I wanted to get out of the restaurant side of the business, so I knew George. He dealt with a lot of other chefs in the area, so I went to him. I said, you know, give me another chef. Give me who's looking for work right now. So he walked me from his office, and he showed me this 600-square-foot retail store, open a couple days a week. And he was just like, if you want it, it's yours. And he's like, you can do what you want with it, but the only thing I'm asking is we roast rotisserie chickens, and we try to sell them. The store's only open about 3 days a week. No one really knew about the retail side of it. And he goes, I'm tired of eating rotisserie chicken every night, so I want you to make a chicken pot pie. So that was the only stipulation of me coming on board Griggstown. So made a chicken pot pie in my mom's kitchen, gave it to George. He liked it, and that was in about 2002.
How many chicken pot pies did you make that year?
We made about 400 that year.
Okay, and by the end of 2012, how many will you make in this year?
About 35,000.
Yeah, that's an incredible story of following the ball, of following the economics. Speaking of the economics, again, we've got a situation here where you've had a farm that was well known in the area for a long period of time. You acknowledge that the name of the farm is a brand, and that brand has really become a signature for not only what you do, but also for what some restaurants serve. When did it become, when did you first start seeing Griggstown Farm chicken on menus, at Gramercy Tavern, at Kraft, things like that? They began to identify where their product was being sourced. You guys were on the front end of that, weren't you?
Yeah, like George started raising quail, like Phil was saying, in the mid-70s, because James Beard was looking for quail. So George, James Beard gave George 12 quail, and that's how we got rolling in the business. And George is quite the character. Chefs like George. George likes chefs. So over, you know, between the 80s and early 90s, George really cultivated a lot of restaurants in New York and got his name out there. He sold directly to about 35, 40 restaurants in New York City. And
selling direct is hard.
It's a lot of work. The problem is with especially restaurants, you know, all over the place, is making sure you get paid. You know what I mean? The restaurant business is in flux all the time. So they have a good week, they have a bad week, they got a new owner, they got a new chef. And so you always have to stay on top of the restaurants.
You know, I think the public does not truly appreciate how week to week the restaurant business is from an economic standpoint. The recent storm really brought that out. It highlighted it. And actually some people finally began to write about it in the New York Times, in particularly that restaurants really are week-to-week cash businesses. So you're right, you're a vendor, and you know, getting paid is your first priority, but the restaurateur always needs terms.
Yep.
You agree to the terms, and then you have a natural disaster like this. Everybody gets negatively affected. I want to talk more about some other disasters that changed your business. But, you know, this continued pattern of seeing opportunity and taking it on is really something that I think the Griggstown Quail Farm is a model of flexibility for. You began, as you talked about, began selling the product. And the product, chicken, quail, pheasant, you know, the late 90s came. There was a sort of a change in the food culture in New York, right?
Mm-hmm.
What happened then? The quail, the pheasant, there, out of style?
There was a couple different things. A lot of bigger distributors moved into New York City. So at the time, there was a lot of farms that specialized in just raising quail or just raising really good chicken, and from either from the south of, you know, in the southern part of the United States up into Canada. So that kind of put a squeeze on our New York City market, which was at that time George's biggest marketplace. And he had a If he didn't have New York, it would definitely put a hurt on his business. And so George saw that this was happening. And at that time, he decided to build a retail store. And, you know, just as a backup plan, that if something were to happen with his business in New York, at least he could then sell products directly off the farm. And there was also a change in tide of what the chefs were producing at the time, the farm would raise a lot of baby pheasants. And what was happening is a lot of the old school French chefs were moving on, getting out of the business, and the new generation of chefs didn't want to do the pheasant under glass and all the old school escoffier type food. There was a new cuisine coming into play. And so the baby pheasant sort of took a back seat, and what became, they were looking for something to fill the hole. And one of the things that came about was called a poussin, which is just a young chicken.
Right. Now, there was also a benefit that came along around that time. You mentioned the growth of distributors.
Yes.
And some specialty distributors. Greggstown Quail Farm was the first farm that the eponymous D'Artagnan engaged to provide product. That's a great story in and of itself. Can you tell us? I mean, D'Artagnan is a household word in the food communities now, and among foodies. But when they were just starting, they leveraged their relationship with Greggstown, right?
Yeah, we were one of D'Artagnan's first farms. We were local at the time. I'm not sure how the relationship between George and the owners of D'Artagnan actually got together. But at the time, George was distributing to New York City. He was distributing to northern New Jersey. And D'Artagnan talked to George into saying, you know, listen, just drop the product off at our door. We'll take care of distribution. You take care of raising the birds because that's what you're good at. You don't have to chase money. You concentrate on the farm, and we'll concentrate on everything else. And that relationship is still going strong onto this day.
Right. It's frankly given the ability to provide Greggstown Quail Farm product to really to the people at large.
Yes.
You can get them at Wegmans. You can get them at Whole Foods. You can get them wherever D'Artagnan products are sold.
Yes.
We're here today being visited by Matt Seitzma, partner and executive chef of the Greggstown Quail Farm in Princeton, New Jersey, www.greggstownquailfarm.com. Matt, when we come back from a short break, we're going to talk about how your inventiveness has tripled the gross revenues coming out of the Greggstown Quail Farm and what you see going on in the future. Phil Colicchio on the business of the business here at RadioNetwork.org, HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Not sparkling shallow
Hi, I'm Steve Jenkins from Fairway Markets. You know, there's no more telling aspect, no more revealing virtue of a group of people having evolved in a lovely way than how they feed themselves, how they entertain, how they put food on the table, what they put on the table. Heritage Radio Network provides the clearest evidence that there's hope for us yet. Heritage Radio's like Fairway Market in that we both care deeply about what you're having for dinner tonight. Heritage Radio Network is not just about food, though. Every time I tune in, I learn something about things other than food, too. Architecture, design, stuff like that. But from where I stand, I still say, if you can't eat it, what's the point? For more information, please visit fairwaymarket.com.
Welcome back to the business of the business here on heritageradionetwork.org. This is Phil Colicchio. And I am sitting with Matt Seitzma, partner and executive chef at the Greggstown Quail Farm, located in Princeton, New Jersey at 484 Bunker Hill Road, less than an hour from Manhattan. So all of you Manhattanites, Brooklynites, Queensites who are interested in seeing a terrific organic operation at its best, come on out and visit Matt. You can certainly visit the Greggstown Quail Farm on the internet at GreggstownQuailFarm.com. Matt, 2001, you were in culinary school, and your dean walked into your classroom and told you that a plane had flown into the World Trade Center. That created a series of events that were not only personally tragic for a lot of people, but economically tragic for the city of New York and the outlying region. What happened to Greekstown Quail Farm as a result of that attack?
George was very heavily invested selling his product into New York. And because a lot of restaurants were closed and just the situation in New York, the downturn, George's bottom line was definitely affected. And George had the retail store that he just built, and it was open a couple days a week, didn't really have a direction, but it was there, and it was kind of his, George took money out of his retirement plan and said, this is what I'm going to do for my backup plan, because he knew that he had to diversify the business in order to stay alive.
11 years later, that backup plan has turned out to be the primary plan of the Greekstown Quail Farm, correct?
Yes.
You were instrumental in really putting that together when you came on. George Rude, a brilliant farmer, understood wholesale, understood distribution, didn't really understand retail, and didn't really understand the farming component.
Yes.
Matt, you walk in and you kind of changed the direction of the company. What was your vision when you walked in there at first? What did you see that was needed, and what did you begin to do?
So when I first came on board, like I mentioned a little bit ago, I saw George. George took me down to the store and said, you know, you can do whatever you want, just make me a chicken pot pie. So that's kind of where the company started, and that's where it, after I was there for a year, I had to work on the poultry farm, doing oddball work that wasn't really the most gratifying, but I knew that I was putting in my time. And at the time, I talked to George into building a small 600 square foot kitchen where we could do prepared foods. And we started.
Now, building a kitchen is it sounds simple and rustic, but I mean, you had to have the USDA involved in that, right?
Yes. So because we have a USDA processing facility on the farm, so the USDA inspectors are there, watch over all the steps, make sure that we're humanely treating the animals as well as they're fit for consumption. So we already had the USDA on the farm, but in order to sell our chicken pot pies wholesale, because they contain more than 1% meat, we needed to have a USDA kitchen. I can sell a million pot pies through the retail store, but the second I sell one to a supermarket and then they go and resell it, that pie has to be USDA inspected.
Right.
So it was, we had to put build a couple different plans in place so that we could sell the pot pies to other retail stores. So that took about a year while we were working on building the kitchen.
And this was your idea, right? Getting the pot pies, the product, out into other markets.
It, like our retail stores, we are a destination location, so that I, you know, George and I both knew that in order to make the kitchen feasible make sure that I, you know, I could stick around and make this thing work, that we couldn't just at that time rely strictly on the retail store, that we had to get into selling product. And we're not a small operation, we're not really a large operation, but our business, there's not really a lot in profit margin, so we have to work on volume.
But you know, again, you had a brand.
You
had a brand that people knew. You had a brand that frankly, James Beard helped to promote,
mm-hmm.
That D'Artagnan helped to promote. You actually probably helped promote D'Artagnan just as much. I said, but here was this known commodity putting out a product like that that somebody could pick up either at the store or in a quality supermarket. Let's fast forward a couple of years. You can't do much work out of a 600-foot kitchen.
No, we actually were able to surprisingly, the business for the first 2 years was kind of slow. I worked by myself, you know, did everything. And then about the third year, I started hiring more employees. We make everything from scratch. We make our own puff pastry. We make our own pie bottoms. For the chicken pot pies, it's all freshly roasted vegetables, freshly roasted chicken. We don't do anything the easy way. Once we started ramping up production, I had to start hiring people. So we were in that kitchen for the last 10 years, but about 8 years ago, I started working with designers and architects on our new kitchen facility, which is 5,000 square feet.
And it's incredible. I've been out there. You've given me a tour. How much additional volume are you going to be able to create with that additional room?
Just for this holiday season, pretty much September, October, November is our busiest time of year. We sell about 2,200 turkeys for Thanksgiving, as well as the heritage breed red bourbon turkeys. We do a lot of school fundraisers, plus our wholesale business to our 35 retail outlets. And in our old kitchen, the most we could do between fruit pies and chicken pot pies is about 1,200 a week. We were able to do about 1,200 a day with our new increased facility, plus also do other product lines at the same time.
Now, I need to brag on you a little bit. So I saw these plans. I saw what you were going to do. I saw that it was going to cost well over $1 million to fit this kitchen out. You did some shopping. How much did it cost you to build that out?
I did it for about $650,000.
That's an incredible savings, because clearly that's $1.5 million to $2 million kitchen.
Yeah, they told me when we first sat down there was going to be about, you know, $1.5 million to $2 million, depending on our costs and stuff like that. And, you know, there was a lot of equipment that was very specialized that I didn't get right now. I said, you know, I'll hold off until I really need it, and then I'll purchase it. But a lot of the savings came in. The A&P supermarket chain went out of business last year, couple years ago, and they auctioned off the stores. And saw one of them was going up to bid, and I went in and pretty much bought all the kitchens for the bakery, the meat room, fish room, and produce room. So all the tables, sinks, hand sinks, and everything like that for about $8,000, including the rack ovens and proofers and everything, which that alone saved me close to $80,000.
Incredible. So that was just nothing other than shoe leather. Right?
Yeah, that was...
no consultant, no architect. That was you going to an auction.
Yeah, it was. We were very fortunate that it all came to... it definitely saved me a lot of money.
You know what? I stick by the adage, the harder I work, the luckier I get.
Yeah.
I know that you worked hard on that. Lest people think that you traded in your farm boots for a jacket and tie and sit in an office and sell pot pies and try to create additional revenue for your company. A couple of years ago, you were at the front end of a sort of a local growing revolution. You put together really the first true CSA in New Jersey, didn't you?
Well, there was... We started the CSA. We were started to do...
CSA.
Oh, CSA stands for Community Supported Agriculture.
Right.
So families buy in shares of the vegetable farm.
Now, you've got 75 acres.
Yes.
At Greigstown. How much of that acreage is dedicated to the CSA now?
We have 12 acres.
Great.
So over the last probably 8 years, the farmers markets, at tailgate markets in the town, stuff like that, they're really good business, but over the last 8 years, they've been slowly, it's been a tougher business because there's so many of them. Every town wants them, and there's just too many of them.
Yeah, I hate to explode a myth, but, you know, the farmers markets are cute, but unless they are run appropriately and unless, frankly, they are geographically diverse, it's a money loser, isn't it?
It can be. So we sat down about 4 years ago and we said, listen, we were doing 12 farmers markets at the time, actually 15 at the time, and we said, listen, we have to cut off, you know, five of them because they're just... we're not really making any money off of them.
Right.
So, but at the same time, I didn't want to lose revenue.
Right.
And I knew that even though our brand and our farm at these farmers markets is a huge draw for people to pick up our fresh poultry and our sausages and our turkey burgers, as well as the pot pies and fruit pies, that I didn't want to lose those customers. And I also knew that even, you know, even though we're there, a big draw is for people to get their fresh tomatoes and their cucumbers and their zucchinis and their walnuts and all this stuff. So what I did was I started the CSA, which stands for Community Supported Agriculture, so people buy in shares, which was becoming kind of up and coming. There was a lot of huge ones around our right. area, but we had the land, we had the infrastructure.
You had the customer base.
We had the customer base,
yeah.
And I was looking for something new to do. And I, even though I'm in the kitchen, I wanted to go back to my roots. Like I said, I grew up on a farm.
That's a good pun.
Yes.
And I'm appreciative that you yeah. threw it in there. I wouldn't have the guts to do it.
Yeah.
But you did. You went back to your roots. You put the boots back on.
Yep.
You went out and did it. You also figured out how to combine it with this new kitchen that you built, which is to me is fascinating. Look, Matt Seisma, not just another pretty face in this business. This is a guy who grew up on a farm, decided he wanted to cook, told his dad when he was 13 that he didn't want to buy the farm from him. Dad sells the farm. Matt's out on his own, knocking on doors, trying to find jobs. So goes to culinary school, decides he doesn't want to do a restaurant, finds himself in restaurants, finds himself at the quail farm. I mean, and now you are the ultimate entrepreneur, the ultimate food entrepreneur.
I have the best of both worlds. I'm a chef on one side, I'm a farmer on the other.
Businessman in the middle?
Yeah, businessman in the middle. If I say, George, can you raise me this? He raises me this. If I want to grow this type of tomato or this type of pepper or this type of cucumber in the field, I order the seeds and we plant them and we go from there.
So Matt, what we're going to see next at the Grahamstown Quail Farm is the ability for a CSA member to buy their product, to actually come into the kitchen. You're going to teach them how to cook it, how to use it. You're going to show them how to preserve it. You're going to show them how to not only preserve it for their own families, but how to create it and donate it to food banks, which is really another great component of what you're doing. Matt, we have to wrap up our talk today.
Okay.
I want to have you back because I want to hear how the business does after a year with the new kitchen. Before we go, there are plenty of people out there who are in this industry who think, wow, this is the iconic, the ideal, right? To own a farm, to create a little retail establishment, to be able to sell my great product to really fancy restaurants. If they want to do that, Matt, what do they need to do?
Hard work. They need to. The hardest part is finding land right now,
yeah.
Definitely going to need some money. But the other thing is, you need to have a passion. You know what I mean? Like, you yeah. just can't go into it and being like, I really like doing this. My mom says I make the best whatever. I grow a cool tomato in the backyard. It's so much harder than that. You know what I mean? And if anyone wants to. You can go to their website and contact me, and I'd be more than willing to share some of my struggles
and, I think
and
you
my
should.
Joys.
I think you should. I think you should go to the website, which is GrahamstownQuailFarm.com. Matt's email is chef@GrahamstownQuailFarm.com. Reach out to him. He's very generous with his advice. He's also very generous with his time. And I'm thrilled that he came out here to Bushwick, Brooklyn to tell us about what he's doing. Carrying on a 40-year-old tradition, bringing it into the new world, into the next century. This is Phil Colicchio. You're listening to The Business of the Business on the heritageradionetwork.org. Maddie, what do you say we go try some of this pizza?
Sounds great. Thank you, Phil.
All right, pal. We'll All see right. you next time.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.